Hey, this is Waz, and you're listening to We Heart Music.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, I proudly present for your listening pleasure, We Heart Music Radio.
So this is Bo from We Heart Music Radio, and I have on the line Derek. Would you say hi?
Hey, what's happening?
All right, awesome. So this is going to be a special Derek episode. Tell us a little bit about yourself and, how you got into music and all that good stuff?
Can do. Sounds like a plan. Well, my name is Derek Pegritz, and I live in southwestern Pennsylvania, south of Pittsburgh, middle of absolute nowhere. Having grown up in this area, pretty much one of the few things that really kept me going in terms of arts and whatnot, especially in the early 80s, I'm 35, I was born in 1973, was music, mainly because my mother was a big fan of a lot of the soft hits of the 70s type stuff, like Don Ho and the Carpenters, and I enjoyed listening to that kind of stuff. I also had a neighbor who was really, really big into heavy metal, like Iron Maiden, stuff like that. I really got into that. And then a channel by the name of MTV debuted back in the early 80s, and that was nothing but old school new wave stuff, and I watched it religiously.
Did you, I wanted to mention that, do you remember the first MTV video that they aired?
Just oh yeah, the Buggles.
Yeah.
Video
yeah,
killed the radio star.
They took the credit for your second symphony, rewritten by machine on new technology.
Yeah, to this day, one of my absolute favorite songs.
It is a great song, though.
Oh, that whole album is just amazing. The Age of Plastic is probably one of the most definitive New Wave albums ever recorded. After MTV, I got this idea in my head that I wanted to start writing music of my own, but I couldn't play anything. I had absolutely no idea. No one I knew played any kind of instruments, and I didn't even know where you'd go to learn anything like that. But fortunately, my cousin had an alto sax that he used to play when he was in the band back in high school. He loaned that sax to me, and when I started junior high back in 1984, I started playing the alto sax because my high school actually had a, or my junior high, had a very, very good band program. And oddly enough, the fellow who was the band director there and taught me to play the alto sax was the same guy that had taught my uncle and my mom and just about everybody else in my family to play the various instruments back in the 1940s and 50s. So he'd been around quite some time, had an absolutely amazing grasp of all kinds of music. His name was, I can't remember his first name, but his last name was Gabrin, Mr. Gabrin. He was the coolest guy on earth. He had a voice like Luciano Pavarotti. Kind of looked like him, too.
Do you still play the sax?
You know, oddly enough, I don't. And the only reason that is my cousin wanted his damn sax back, and I've never been able to afford another one, because they're like $7,000. Honest to God, a sax costs more than my car. And after that, really all I did was watch MTV, which by that point had already started turning into just a sort of like general cultural channel. They really weren't showing a whole lot of music videos on there anymore. And of the videos that they did show, most of them were just top 40 type stuff, like Exposé, for instance.
Right. I wanted to talk a little. I don't want to turn this into an MTV special, but
yeah.
Do you find that I always feel really bad about MTV because I think at first they're really promoting like good music, and then as they gradually progress and it became more hip hop and more top 40, that it seems kind of clear to me that these big record labels were basically just paying MTV to play their music.
Oh, it's the new version of payola is what it is. Major record labels have basically completely ruined the concept of video on or music on television. It completely ruined it. Like when MTV first debuted, all of the videos that were really being shown on there were pretty independent types of stuff. I mean, a lot of the videos were financed by the bands themselves.
Right, and I hate to point this out, but a lot of them seems kind of cheesy, you know, kind of like overdramatic.
Oh, yeah,
almost.
Extremely.
Like, you look at, like, Till Tuesday's videos, like, super overdramatic, and, like,
oh,
you know,
God,
they
yeah.
take, like, Pat Benatar takes it so seriously, you know, like... That is laughable, you know. But
I know.
But they didn't know what videos are supposed to look like back then, you know.
And a lot of the early videos were, you know, you had really good songs. A good song will stand on its own. Perfect example is Gary Newman's "Cars," my favorite song of all time. Video you're gonna do for that?
You can be just very have him driving around in a car, you know.
Yeah, exactly. You could be very literal and just have him driving around in a car someplace, or you could do something completely unrelated to the song, which is what Newman eventually did on that. I mean, the video is basically just him and a couple other people standing around behind old Moog keyboards. Basically, that's it. It's very, very minimalistic, very, very stripped down. The whole world became kind of obsessed with music videos during the 80s. For a while, that led to very, very, very incredible types of videos. I mean, you've got Michael Jackson's Thriller, for instance.
Oh, yeah, that's a classic. It's directed by John Landis, and
yep.
He was primarily known as kind of like a comedy director until he did, like, Werewolf in London, which is kind of like a horror, but it's also a kind of a comedy element to it.
Exactly.
Right, but what I really like about the Thriller video is that it's not just a video for a song. It's like a mini movie.
Exactly. It's a great narrative. I mean, when I was a kid, I've been obsessed with horror movies since I was, you know, old enough to know what they are. And
what was your first horror movie that really scarred you?
Oh, the one that scarred me the most is definitely, without a doubt, American Werewolf in London.
Oh, yeah.
I saw that at a way too impressionable age and was terrified of werewolves probably until 1989.
I'm just slightly a little younger than you, but my first, like, major scarring movie was Hellraiser 2, which to this day I can't bring myself to watch, and it is just you know, now that I actually watch it, it's kind of like almost, you know, cheesy. Not cheesy, but like not as scary as I once
yeah exactly was. You know, once you get a little experience under your belt and whatnot, it becomes, it's obviously not as terrifying as it was, you know, when you saw it at a younger, more impressionable type of age. But, yeah, the Hellraiser movies were just... I honestly couldn't watch them until probably I was... They came out when I was in high school. I didn't even start watching them until I was well into college, because I honestly to God didn't even think I could handle them.
Actually,
they were... The first one was incredibly visceral, and the second one is just... I mean, to this day, there are scenes in that, the second one, that just... You know, chill your blood. The guy writhing around on the mattress with the razor blade trying to get the bugs off of him. I mean, that's just...
That's gross, yeah. Actually, you know, I have to point out that during this period in the 80s is that I think gore was really setting in. And so you have movies like Evil Dead 2, Hellraiser, the Jason movies and all that was kind of like concentrating on gore. And just brutal deaths and gore, and Yeah, I think for a while that was a thrive. That was the staple of horror movies. And And actually, you know, I haven't said Evil Dead 2. Looking back, it's more of a comedy. Like now that I'm older, but when I was younger, you know, Evil Dead 2 just scared the crap out of me, especially when that eyeball is flying across the room. I mean, now I look at it, I'm laughing at it because it's just so ridiculously bad, you know. But
well, that's the same thing with Evil Dead. I mean, when I first saw that, I thought that was the most frightening movie of all damn time. And I look at it now, I'm like, good Lord, I was actually scared by this. I mean, it's so over the top and incredibly dramatic, just like that Till Tuesday video we mentioned earlier. That, I mean, it takes itself so relentlessly serious and yet is just dealing with the most goofy possible things.
I thought the first one was very slow pace. It's still Did you know it's actually banned in England, that movie?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's part of the video nasties that was basically in Britain. They compile a list of all the movies that are too horrific for human consumption. And of course, when they made that list, it was like a must-see list. You know, I gotta see.
Oh, absolutely!
I gotta see the
anytime
killer.
Anytime somebody puts together a "you cannot watch this because it will screw you up for life" kind of list.
Thanks for the list.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that right there might as well just say, "Please watch these movies because you know you're guaranteed to love them." Clockwork Orange is on that list, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, actually, that's a great film, though. I mean, despite that brutal scene at the beginning, but it's still it's kind of like a film that kind of has a statement about society and about, I mean, it's, you have to look beyond that you know, violence, you know what I mean?
Exactly. The violence in that film is really only there to back up the character study, because it's a study, it's basically a film that is a study of youth gone wild, I guess you could say. And the really interesting thing about that film was that was the film that really got me back into music. I didn't see it until I was probably a senior in high school. And I'd been hearing a lot about this film. It was described as incredibly violent, just really, really screwed up and bizarre. And of course, to a 17-year-old boy, that's like, oh my God, you might as well just buy me a copy of it immediately. When I was watching it, the music by Walter, now Wendy Carlos, in it was just amazing, because that was probably one of my first exposures to honest to God 100% electronic music.
Was it mostly like instrumental? Because I don't remember hearing any lyrics or anything in the soundtrack.
It's almost entirely instrumental. As a matter of fact, most of the tracks on there are just performed by Wendy Carlos on an old-school Moog synthesizer. And they're all really, really... a lot of them are just renditions of classical music. There's a couple of Bach pieces on there, for instance, and a few original compositions as well. But the really interesting thing about it is it's got a very intellectual kind of sound to it. The film takes those kinds of sounds and does something futuristic with them that kind of fits that sort of pseudo-futuristic dystopian kind of environment.
Oh, yeah.
It was that film that really, really got me interested in the possibilities of electronic music. And after that, I discovered Blade Runner, which
that's a great film.
I'd seen that when I was a kid, and I liked it to a certain degree, but then the director's cut version of it came out, which is the proper form of the film. You know, the Vangelis soundtrack to that was just mind-blowing.
Actually, mention that... okay, for those who haven't seen the film, the director's cut actually kind of... gives clue that maybe Harrison Ford's character is a replicant.
Yeah,
and, did you get
that's
that
the best
impression?
Part about it.
Okay, and because part of the clue is that he would ask, he would tell the replicants that, oh, they dream about horses or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And Harrison Ford's character actually dreams about the same thing that he was. So it's not just like suggesting he's a replicant. I think he pretty much is a replicant, because If you think about it, in a future where everybody has a meaningful job, a replicant hunter seems kind of like something that it would probably be meant for a replicant. I don't know. Just my take on it.
I totally agree. I mean, in an environment like that, as they always say, you know, the best thing to hunt somebody down is another one of their kind.
What are you looking at? Like, I notice you want to get in a book or something, are you going to review this book on We Heart Music?
Yes, as a matter of fact. I encountered this book at the Barnes & Nobles last week, and I'm going to pick up a copy of it here shortly. It is called The Indie Band Survival Guide, The Complete Manual for the Do-It-Yourself Musician, by Randy Chertkow and Jason Feehan. I have the Amazon.com page for it up in front of me right now, and I'll just read the little Publisher's Weekly blurb here to kind of give listeners an idea of what this book involves. According to Publisher's Weekly, in this indispensable guide for indie musicians, Chertkow and Feehan, lead members of the Chicago band Beatnik Turtle, I've never heard of them, explain how they managed successfully to get their music out to the public, to produce 4 albums, to build a huge following, and to write music for television shows and theater without the benefit of a record label. Covering topics such as building a brand, networking, website, getting booked, playing live, and getting publicized, Chertkow and Feehan pass along advice that, while sometimes self-evident, encourages bands to exploit the internet and to become web-savvy to make a name for themselves. For example, in illustrative detail, they spell out clearly the terms of contracts, such as non-exclusive, that can often be so fuzzy in the industry. In their section on getting booked, they remind bands that the essence of a good show is remembering that the band is there for the audience, and the authors explain step by step all the ups and downs of dealing with bookers, scheduling, booking kits, etc. Because this lively book offers such essential guidance in these changing times, no band should be without a copy. I've read a good portion of it just sitting in the Barnes & Noble. And yes, some of it is stuff that, you know, one would think should probably be self-evident to anyone who has any idea what the internet is. But, you know, there are people who aren't. You know, and that's one of the reasons.
That kind of, like, amazes me because, to me, it just seems if I'm going to start a band, I'm going to go MySpace or CD
exactly.
Baby or try to... get into iTunes, for instance, but it's so weird that you should mention that because, as I know, a lot of bands who sign up through PR companies, they can do that themselves, and it just seems like because they don't understand the internet as a monster, they hire like a company, like a PR company, to do. What I think is actually very simple, and it kind of amazes me that people don't really know the internet. You know what I mean?
Exactly. And the thing is, you know, you can never really assume that anyone is going to know something. And to be perfectly honest, that's one of the reasons why I absolutely love the Dummies books, for instance, because they assume much like. This book does, The Indie Band Survival Guide, they assume that you don't know anything about this. And you would be surprised at how much stuff you can learn by taking that sort of approach, because there are things that, you know, everyone takes for granted, and you may think that you know everything about it, but it turns out you don't. And those types of books that take that straightforward, here is everything you need to know. We're going to explain to you all of the ins and outs and everything you need to know about this is a great, great service because it really does. Just like you said, it shows people how to do a lot of that promotional stuff. And, you know, you can do it for yourself. You do not have to pay a promotional company to do this kind of stuff. And the Indie Band Survival Guide pretty much covers all of that stuff so that as a do-it-yourself musician, you can do everything from setting up your own web page to getting your stuff out there to playing shows. And the book is full of practical advice of how to do that kind of stuff. So I'm going to be talking about that a little bit more at length probably next week once I actually get the book and have a chance to read over it. But even just taking 5-10 minutes and glancing through the different sections of it, I can tell you that it looks like it is an amazingly thorough book, and it is the kind of thing that even people who are web savvy, who know a lot about how the internet works and the potential for promoting their music with it, even somebody like that who's been doing it for years can benefit from a book like this, because there's guaranteed to be something in there that perhaps you haven't thought about.
You know, that's actually a great, it sounds like a really good, thorough book, and it sounds like it's mostly concentrated on just internet. Do they mention at all about radio at all, or cracking into a traditional media, as it were?
They deal with that, too. Their primary focus is obviously the internet, but they do cover a wide range of, I mean, they basically cover the entire panoply of venues and stuff that you can do to get your stuff heard. They cover radio, they cover live shows. I mean, they literally cover everything.
Huh. Well, I also wanted to mention that I think the majority of bands who go through a PR company is possibly not because they probably don't know about the internet and how to do promotion, which is probably the case, but I think a lot of times the bands just don't have the time, because it sounds like
exactly.
It takes a lot of time and commitment in order to do some of this.
And beyond any shadow of a doubt, it does. It does take a substantial amount of commitment to get your stuff out there and heard. If you're willing to put that time in, if you're able to put that kind of time in, then that's great. You can do it yourself. But I'm not about to denigrate publicity organizations and promoters, because, you know, some people just do not have the time to do that. That's where people like Ariel Publishing and stuff like that come in. Is if you don't have the time to do it yourself, certainly you can, but that doesn't mean that you're going to be able to, you know, really take the time out of your schedule to do that. That's where PR companies come in. They obviously are there to pick up the slack if you're not able to do that for yourself.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you should mention Ariel, because did you know that they used to be a traditional PR company?
Yep.
Oh, you did. And I know for a while they had really big clients, like they had what's that, the George Clinton guy, the funk guy?
Yeah, George Clinton.
Yeah,
P-Funk.
Yeah, he was on their roster of artists, as well as like just major artists. I can't think of any off the top of my head, but they kind of abandoned that in favor of the internet as soon as they start seeing more potential in and one of the reason, and I talked to a lot of one of the reps, and he was telling me how the reason why is you have this untapped market of the internet where they saw growth in it, and so they basically dropped all their traditional stuff and just went digital as
exactly.
And I think it's actually good for them, but at the same time, you really can't ignore traditional media, because I know the majority of people still consume music through radio, magazines, and television.
Exactly.
Mostly. So, but those are really hard to crack. And I know for a fact that radio is just really hard, because now that they're all owned by Disney.
Exactly. Clear Channel.
Yeah, so it's really tough to crack, and unless you know you're the Jonas Brother who has a contract with Disney Radio, your stuff isn't gonna get heard, especially if you're an indie band. And so
exactly.
Yeah, I mean,
the thing is, though, here's something to keep in mind, and this is mentioned in the Indie Band Survival Guide, but it's something that I just personally discovered myself through being active in the Pittsburgh music scene for quite a number of years. There are a lot of radio stations out there, and not all of them, surprisingly enough, are owned by Clear Channel or any other type of, you know, big-name pop radio kind of thing. There are a lot of independent radio stations out there. For instance, in Pittsburgh, the two that come to mind most obviously, first one is WYEP. YEP, for instance, handles all manner of independent music. They love that. That is what they exist for. And there are plenty of radio stations like that, and there are also a lot of college radio stations. WRCT from Carnegie Mellon University is a perfect example of that. I've discovered so much music by listening to YEP and RCT over the years that it's an indispensable resource. You know, you can't just confine yourself to using the internet alone. When there are places like YEP and RCT that you can send stuff to. Unfortunately, though, you do have to do a little bit of digging to discover them out there. YEP and RCT are both pretty big in Pittsburgh, so if you have any kind of... anyone who takes a part in the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania music scene is going to know about them sooner or later. But if you're going to try to find that information for other cities... You know, if you're not, for example, let's say Philadelphia, you know, I don't do a whole lot of stuff out there. But if I want to really promote stuff, I'm going to want to research, you know, independent radio stations in the Philadelphia area. So it does take a little bit of legwork, but trust me, they're out there.
I also wanted to mention, speaking of college radio, which actually exists all across the nation, but it's very... what's the word? It's very regional. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So if you're getting massive airplay in Georgia, that you're pretty much contained in Georgia. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
And that's, I think that's one of the bad things about traditional media, where it's just kind of regional as far as radio is concerned, because
exactly.
It only reaches a certain area. And I also wanted to mention that. Did you know I used to be a radio DJ?
That doesn't surprise me. I was too.
Oh, you were? Did you?
Yep.
Well, I volunteered at KFSR 90.7, which is our college radio station, and it only had a small reach of the city. But as far as I knew, we were getting music submitted to us. It's just an insane amount of music, and especially from local artists who. Would basically stalk you in a way where they'll come to your radio
yeah.
station, knock on your door, and demand you play their record. And I mean, that's kind of scary, but it does happen.
There are aggressive people out there.
Actually, there was this one hip hop artist, a rapper, who was kind of like a gangster rapper who basically scared the crap out of us because we. Didn't play his music, and he was going to come down to the station to find out why. And we're like, hey, you know, it's not part of our format. You know, we don't play hip-hop. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
But, yeah, that's another story altogether. My radio days were really fun. I mean, I look back, and I was like, I was so naive back then. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah.
And
I look back at the time that I was I used to help a friend of mine do a show on RCT. He had originally started off primarily doing industrial music.
Is that your college station, or is it like a local like station down there?
WRCT was that's Carnegie Mellon University's.
Okay, so it's a college kind of university station. Okay. So go on.
And he would primarily focus on industrial stuff to start with, but he wanted to start branching out into more forms, different forms of more like avant-garde electronic stuff. So he kind of got me in, you know, for that. And we did that show for, it was a while, at least probably most of a year. And, you know, I discovered a massive amount of stuff there. And one of the really interesting things is we would get a lot of local artists who would just bring in CDs or send them to us. And we discovered a lot of really good bands that way. I mean, it's definitely a way to get noticed. But again, just like you said, a college radio station is only going to have a fairly limited regional appeal. Pittsburgh, for instance, is pretty WRCT pretty much covers Pittsburgh. Right. If you want to get noticed in some other market other than Pittsburgh, you know, you've got to start researching those types of radio stations in other cities as well. And that can become kind of daunting.
I saw the future. The geeks were right.
All right, so, yeah, let's just wrap this up. What are you listening to lately? What have you been playing?
Well, I've been listening to The Faint's new album pretty much on repeat for the last, I don't know, week or so. It's just fantastic. The lead single from it, The Geeks Were Right, which they actually released in July, is just an absolutely perfectly awesome song. The whole album is, actually. I mean, there's some really... It's not only is the music itself really aggressive and, you know, kind of shows them taking a more sharp-edged kind of approach to writing. The lyrics are very, very interesting. They're very... In many senses, they're very deep. I mean, they give you something to think about. And what's also really cool about this album is The Faint have left Saddle Creek, and they actually set up their own label called No Wave Records, and this is the first release from it. So they're doing this 100% independently. And
you know, I'm seeing a lot of that where bands, once they are a little more successful, have decided to self-release their music, and I can't cite any off the top of my head, but I've noticed like a lot of bands.
Yeah, that's a very smart way of approaching things. And, you know, it's not just really, you know, popular or successful artists that do this. Within the synth pop world, for instance, two of the most successful artists of, well, really, the last 10 years was Mark Nicholas, who used to release music under the name Cosmicity, and a band called Iris. Both Mark and Iris were with A Different Drum, which was one of the number one synth-pop labels in the entire world for the late 90s and early 2000s. And both of them, even though, you know, from what I gather, A Different Drum was a great label to be with, both Mark and Iris are now releasing stuff 100% independently, and they're doing very well at it.
Do you think it's more of a control, or is it more of a money, or what do you think bands like to release their own stuff on their own label?
I think it all ultimately comes down to an issue of control. Simple as that. If you're releasing something yourself, you have complete and utter control over every single element of that project. Everything from the recording to the composition to the marketing and distribution, you all have that completely under your control. Now, I can see whereas, you know, if you get a deal with A Different Drum, that's great because they're going to, you know, foot the bill for touring, for distribution and stuff like that. That's a good thing.
But they
also
take a lot of that profit, don't they? I mean, as far as I know, the record label gets a lot of that percentage.
And even with independent labels, that's just how labels work. They reap the lion's share of the profit. If you're releasing something independently, however, guess who that money goes to?
Right,
you.
Directly to you. Yeah, yeah. You know, I'm actually, what I like about The Faint is they always kind of reminds me of this kind of 80s, like, retro sound, you know, that are kind of made popular again recently, but I really like that sound, and I think they do a great job at reproducing that.
I've been a new wave freak since day one. I mean, I grew up right about the time that post-punk was really hitting, and Gang of Four and Tube Way Army, people like that were, you know, coming out of Factory Records in Britain. I was 6, 7, 8 years old, And I didn't really get exposed to a lot of that locally, but through MTV, obviously I did. I mean, I got to see all kinds of stuff there. And I heard a lot of it at a local radio, local college radio station, California University of Pennsylvania, which is just over the hill from where I live. You know, they had a lot, they were playing a lot of stuff on there as well. So one thing I've always maintained is that new wave music never really died. It never really disappeared. It started off, the whole post-punk aesthetic was very, very strongly independent, very DIY, and most of the original
Don't you think that it's actually in response to new wave? Because, like, if you look at new wave, they're all, like, gorgeously dressed with, like, fancy clothing and like, kind of, like, DIY punk kind of, like, spit mm-hmm. that in your face and say, hey, we're like ratty tatty and we're ugly and our music isn't overproduced, and you know, isn't that like more like a response to the new romantics and that kind of movement?
Well, the odd thing is that all of those the term new wave was basically an artificial term created by a radio DJ just to describe this new resurgence of music following basically the death of punk in 1978. But
a lot of like synthesizer kind of came in around this time and it made popular.
But
wasn't it pretty limited too? Because your synthesizer couldn't produce some of the, I don't know, like more demanding sounds, I guess. It sounds like it's very simple. It was very like simple beats, basically.
Exactly. And the really cool thing about that is that even though synths were coming out and were being used more and more and more, most of the original post-punk and new wave bands really like to focus on creating what I like to call a very full sound. They would have a drummer, bassist, guitarist, you know, your fairly established instruments that you would find in any rock band. But then they would supplement that with everything from live or synthesized horns to synthesizer sounds. And what that did was that created it really did create a new wave in music, because on the one hand you had a lot of the prog rock bands and arena rock bands of the 70s. They were the first people to really start incorporating synths and synthetic sounds into their music. But what the whole new wave kind of thing did was it took that kind of sound, that sort of, you know, synthesizer plus traditional instrumentation sound, and made it much more stripped down and much more not that kind of epic, bombastic prog rock kind of sound. It was kind of taking the aesthetic of, you know, punk, that kind of in-your-face but straightforward music, and it's basically what you get when you've got the synthesizer world of prog rock and disco colliding with the punk aesthetic. And that pretty much produced almost all of the bands that we today would regard as like new wave icons, like Duran Duran, etc., etc. But the interesting thing about that was from day one, the whole post-punk and new wave aesthetic was, like I said, very, very DIY. Very underground. It just so happened, though, that sound really caught on, and that for a while in the early 80s, it was riding high, and you got really, really polished bands with very, very polished images, such as Duran Duran, for instance, and you end up with that kind of pop new wave sound. But at the same time, there were still a lot of very underground new wave bands out there doing their thing, as always before, and you know, honestly, those bands never disappeared. There were artists working in that genre all through the 90s, very, very independently, very, you know, underground. Basically, you know, new wave had its moment where it became incredibly popular, and there were a number of very new wave influenced pop acts out there. But then it kind of went underground again, and that's pretty much where it's been for the last, 15, 20 years. But it's getting this kind of resurgence now because Some of it is, you know, obviously a reaction to new wave stuff. A lot of the younger artists today, they grew up listening to that stuff in their childhood, and it naturally became an influence on them to a certain degree. But also, the genre's just been there, you know, it's been plugging along, as it has pretty much from, you know, its inception, and it's just having another major resurgence in popularity. And honestly, the Faint are probably one of the reasons why bands like The Killers are popular these days. Yeah. The Faint really started bringing that sound back, and then The Killers just basically took that kind of that sort of sound and made a much more polished version of it.
You know, I want to say that it seems like a lot of the new wave kind of went to kind of modern rock / alternative sound of the 90s. And
yep.
So, yeah, you're right. You may be right that it kind of like really never left. I mean, bands like Depeche Mode was kind of still carrying on that torch for a while, you know.
And you'd have smaller independent acts like Romania, for instance, Iris when they first came out. All these different kinds of bands had been maintaining, you know, working within that kind of new wave sound. It's just that they weren't being heard on the radio anymore. It you know, there wasn't a massive pop radio interest in that field any longer. It had its moment in the sun with, you know, really, really popular music in the early 80s. But then, you know, pop sensibilities are very, very fickle, and it changed. But that didn't mean that that sound disappeared. It just no longer was in the limelight.
Huh. All right. Anything else besides The Faint or any on your iPod or Zune?
Well, let's see. I've also been listening to a group called Gramercy Arms.
Yeah,
that, from what I gather, is sort of like a super group of just about every major musician in New York City. Very, very, very good kind of pop rock in the style of, say, 80s type of pop rock, like Richard Marx, John Mellencamp, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, kind of like
but a little bit more...
like a stadium kind of rock.
Not quite. It's a little bit more indie sounding than that.
Okay.
But just very, and just straight up great rock music.
All right. I'm actually listening to a couple of CDs for review because I've noticed we got quite a bit coming out on next Tuesday. And so I'm taking care of Likey Lee's album. And
Likey Lee?
Yeah. Likey Lee. Probably saying her name wrong.
I pronounce it. I think it sounds funnier to say Likey Lee, but that's just me. Anyway.
I like saying Likey because, you know, you Likey.
Yeah, exactly.
I kind of listened to this album all of last night, it's released through her own label called LL Recording, which is, you know, Likey Lee. And you know what's really funny is I didn't know this, but apparently that's her first name. Lee is not like her last name. It's kind of like Mary Jane, you know, where that's one name. Well, Likey Lee or Likey Lee, that is actually her name, her first name. Her last name is actually Zaria Rakusen or something like that. It's very Swedish sounding. But and I can understand why she dropped her last name, just because it's so weird that people won't remember it. But
yeah, Likey Lee, much like Björk. I mean, Björk's last name is Gudmund's daughter.
Yeah, I love Björk though. Like especially from her Sugar Cubes day. She has quite a voice on some of her those early releases. Like if you listen to Birthday, it's like. The sounds she makes, it's just, it's not humanly possible.
I know, she's got this just wonderfully insane voice, and, I actually picked up some CDs. I found a blog on the internet called Mutant Sounds, and that is, I believe, mutantsounds.blogspot.com, that actually put, they found the old vinyl of her first band, which was called Tappy Ticker Ass.
Yeah, actually, I have that, actually.
Really?
It's very, yeah, it's... I have most of her early stuff, from her jazz trio to her... You'd be surprised, but she was actually doing a lot of music prior to the Sugar Cubes.
Oh, yeah. And, quite a lot.
Yeah, and it
she's
was kind
got
of
quite
like
the
a,
pedigree.
Right, and it was like, I think she started off in like punk almost, where it's kind of like do-it-yourself kind of thing before. And then she ventured into jazz, which is very interesting. And then she ventured into, eventually ended up being what she is, which is, you know, a superstar of Iceland.
Yeah, a little bit of everything.
But anyway, yeah, so I've been listening to Leaky Lee, and, you know, I really like it. So I'm probably going to put up the review tonight, and then I just got to listen to some of the other CDs coming out, which I don't think I'm going to hit my deadline on those, but that's all right, you know. I think a lot of the record label kind of know that they are sending us way too much music than we can actually cover, so
yeah, there's only so much that you can actually, you know, listen to in a week.
Right. And anyway, but yeah, I might be doing more like international kind of posting pretty soon. Where not, you know, I mean, I as much as I like you know, American music, there's, you know, the rest of the world is out there, and I think
exactly
a lot of, yeah, if you look at a lot of like music blogs or whatever, they're only primarily concentrating on their very niche kind of small, you know, like if they like American rock and roll, that's all they ever cover.
Exactly.
And then you look at, say, somebody who's blogging from the UK, only covers UK bands, you know. And so hopefully I'm going to be doing more like, you know, from different countries, from Finland to, you know, Yugoslav, you know, Ukraines or something like that.
I'm actually working on two reviews right now. One is for a band called Bobby, and they're from Sweden. And again, as I like to say, I've said this millions of times, and I will maintain it for the rest of my life, nothing bad comes out of Sweden.
I love never, the Swedes.
Seriously. Literally, I have never heard a single piece of music from Sweden that wasn't amazing. And Bobby is just, I mean, they are the absolute epitome of synth pop. They have incredibly, you know, wonderfully emotive, memorable, very melodic songs that, you know, just, they just literally make you want to get up and boogie. There's nothing you, and they're just incredible. I mean, the music is amazing.
You know,
and since you mentioned Ukraine, and that reminded me of Estonia, there's a artist named Curly. Her name's spelled K-E-R-L-I, who I recently discovered. She's Estonian, and she does music that sounds like a combination of Evanescence and Björk.
Is that kind like of near Russia?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Estonia's on the border of Russia.
Yeah, don't they actually speak Russian in Estonia?
They speak Russian there, but also there is an Estonian language as well. But Russian is, of course, spoken there as well. It's just like a common trade tongue.
So is her album in English then? I'm assuming it's in English.
Yeah, the whole album's in English, actually.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Good songwriting, too. That's the very interesting thing about it. Is the songs are really memorable, and quite a few of them feature some really clever lyrics.
Well... You know, it kind of reminds me of, like, Japanese pop, where they kind of use English, but it doesn't make any sense at all. And you know, I'm assuming, like, this Estonia girl, her lyrics are probably going to make a lot more sense than, say, you know, like, go, you know, protect my balls songs. You know?
Yeah, exactly. I like Japanese music as well, but this stuff is actually a lot more interesting because... it's clear that the girl, she understands English very, very well, and she's not just stringing together random clumps of English words together to form something.
Right, because it sounds good or whatever, yeah. All right, so, I think that's going to wrap it up. We should actually continue doing this next week, because obviously I think we got a lot to say. And
yeah.
But we're going to wrap this up, so, I don't know, is there any particular song you'd like to play out on, or, I kind of have something in mind, if you don't have anything.
Well, what do you have in mind?
Well, I was just going to do, Leaky Lee, because, you know, that's what I've been listening to, so it's kind of, like, on top of my mind right now, but, I mean, we don't have to go out with that, because, like I said, I was going to write an article on her anyway, so...
Actually, that sounds like a pretty good idea, because it's always a good idea to get, especially since we're primarily centered in the United States here, it's good to get, like, you know, European and other non-American artists a venue to get, you know, to give them a more... chance of developing a fan base here in the States.
I think she's gonna get that base. I think, you know, if you're not a fan of her already, you're probably not gonna like her. But, you know what's really funny about Sweden is, like, everything that comes out, it's very diverse. I mean, you got, like, everything from heavy metal to pure rock and roll to, you know, pop. I mean, like indie pop. Kind of twee.
You get anything and everything from the Swedes.
Right, and they're not bad. I mean, they're all really worth your time. And, well, anyway, so anyway, the song that I kind of wanted to use was I'm Good, I'm Gone, because, and I've heard the song before in a live setting, and it didn't have the same kind of impact when I heard it on the studio version, because once I listened to the studio version, I was like, what is this song? It is so good. And there's really no words that can really describe it. It's just this feeling where it's like the music's just surging through you, and you just want to... I mean, I can't describe why it's good. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's certain
I love that kind of music. It's just, you know, it hits you, and it almost like it fills up your body with energy. It's almost impossible to describe the exact feeling or the exact atmosphere. I mean, you can say, like, okay, well, it's primarily string heavy and it's kind of got a pop feel or whatever. But there are some songs that just have to be experienced.
Right, and this is one of those songs where I didn't quite understand her lyrics or the words she's saying. She has a very, like, peculiar accent, you know? And so I didn't quite, like, understand what she was singing, but it's the feeling where it just makes you... it's so hard to explain. You just gotta hear it, you know what I mean? And it's one of those things that I can see her move into the song in this particular way that she would dance to the song, and it, you know, it just makes me want to get up and move at the same time. And it's, you know, it's probably not the most intelligent song, but it doesn't matter. It feels right.
Exactly.
Anyways,
as I always like to say, you know, I have a threefold definition of music. There's music that's good because it breaks new ground. There's music that's good just because it does whatever it's trying to do very, very well. It doesn't have to be original. It doesn't have to be, you know, extremely inventive. It's just good. It just makes you feel really good. And then there's music that sucks. But, you know, number two, the music that, you know, it's not really breaking ground, but it's just amazing. It just, you know, hits you because it's just so well done. Sometimes that kind of music is just as important as music that breaks new ground.
Right, right. You know, I'm more normally, like, really into lyrics and really into the storytelling aspect of songs. That's why I like a lot of, like, folk song, because
they
all kind of tell the story and you can follow it, and like country music, really. But you know, sometimes you don't need all that, and this is one of the songs.
Working in the corner, peeking off the shows, waiting for my time to come. Working in the corner, one bit to the other. I'm all gone. Yeah, I'm walking by the
film, because you know I love films and I can just talk more about it, but we're already 20 minutes in and it's just not and we gotta bring it back to music, and maybe we should just do a movie podcast or something, because I can honestly tell you talk about movies all day, because
God, you and I both for one thing, do not get me started on John Carpenter's The Thing.
Oh, you know what? I love that film, though. Like, I know people who don't like it, but
I don't know why.
I know it's
I don't know how you
film.
Can dislike it.
No, it's a remake of like a 50s movie, and his version is definitely far superior than the original black and white. And
It's light years better.
Yeah, and I think actually, are they remaking the Carpenter film? Like recently?
No, supposedly I've heard Sci-Fi Channel has decided that they're going to.
Don't.
yeah, exactly.
Please, Sci-Fi, if you're listening, don't remake that classic. It's a classic. It should just stay there, you know.
Really, it's one of those kind of films that I don't see how you can improve on. It's just great the way it is.
Right.
Some of the creature transformations may be a little bit more exotic and a little bit stranger now that, you know, we can do it in computers and stuff like that, but it's not going to improve the storyline whatsoever. There's nothing that can be added to the film today that's going to make it any better than it was.
I hate to say it, but I prefer the traditional monster makeup, because
that
looks more real than, say, like you can always kind of tell like when something isn't quite right, especially like if you look at like Spider-Man, where he's like swinging across, he has no weight, he just seems like he's just like light and images that just fly across. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't feel real. And you know, if you look at the Sandman, I don't know if you've seen Spider-Man 3. It's a horrible.
Oh yeah, I've seen all of them.
Oh, it's a horrible movie. The third one's the worst. But
yeah, it's god awful.
Yeah, but when the Sandman appeared, and he's made out of sand. It doesn't look like sand. Like to me, it just looks fake. And I pretty much prefer like the thing where they're using real puppetry and real monster make. It is kind of like a lost art in a way, because you don't have like Savini working on this anymore, because it's all computer, I miss
there's no
days.
Weight to it anymore.
Exactly. Yeah
there's no weight of the realism to it. But anyway, since you were saying to kind of
let's take it
wrench
back to
things
music.
Back
yeah.
Wrench things back to music here. Speaking of The Thing, the soundtrack to The Thing was another huge influence on me that really got me into exploring the possibilities of electronic music, because, first of all, it was the score was done by Ennio Morricone, one of the greatest soundtrack
artists. Oh, the Italian master, right?
Oh, God, yes.
See, that guy has made more movie soundtrack than anybody ever. Like, seriously, this guy works like 300 films, and they're all incredible, and they're all original material. And especially if you look at his westerns to his sci-fi, it's just amazing that this guy can pull it off.
Yeah, I mean, he does such an incredible job of that that it's just, it's mind-blowing. One of the things that I particularly liked about it was the fact that he just has this huge breadth of ability. And he can create a soundtrack from, you know, quite literally anything. For example, his Spaghetti Western soundtracks, especially the soundtrack to Once Upon a Time in the West, is just this incredibly beautiful, very, very lush, kind of just immersive sound. And then you have his work on John Carpenter's The Thing, which is extremely minimalist. I mean, literally to the point that the main theme for The Thing is literally just a plodding bass line with a few flourishes of strings here and there.
Could I talk about, like, Once Upon a Time in the West?
Go for it. It's one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite Western, Spaghetti Western, actually. It is literally, like, over 3 hours long, and it stars with the Death Wish guy. What's his name? Charles Bronson. Incredible movie. And for everything from the beginning shot of his eyes to, I mean, it's just, this is the quintessential, like, Western. And I think it was made even at a time when the Western were kind of dying down, you know?
And yeah, exactly.
It was super popular for a while. And so you got everybody making, you know, there's over like 300 Spaghetti Western easily movies, you know, that came out of Italy around the same time. And this is one of the last film, and it is his swan song. It is one of the best movie that Sergio Leone made, and it's just every time I watch it, it just blows me away how masterful he is, and like things that you would normally like a director would do two or three cuts. This guy is doing it with one sweeping cut, and it's all planned out. He knows what he's doing, you know. It's just.
That's something you don't see very much in film anymore either, is right. That sort of...
this editor kind of eye.
Exactly. You don't see much of the long, really, really kind of languid shots that set up an environment and really create a scene. Most films today are just... that all the scenes are very, very short. There's a lot of jump
it's
cuts.
It's very MTV-ish.
Like yes, very. And, you know, there's a time and place for something like that. But when you're dealing with something where you're trying to create an atmosphere, it's
right,
easier
right.
to create a very atmospheric type of setting by paying attention to all the little elements, such as Peter Fonda's eyes, such as an establishing shot of a train approaching for, you know, 30, 40 seconds. That really sets the tone and gives a viewer a chance to really enjoy everything that's happening on the screen. You don't really get that when every single cut is just you know, hammering at you something different every 5 seconds.
Right, and you know, and it kind of when you have a slow shot like that, it gives you time to like take everything in, notice all the setting, and it's he really. I think it's one of the best film, and I think people should watch this film and study it because
oh, yeah.
it's just one of the best. Anyway, speaking of. You remember the soundtrack to The Good and the Bad and the Ugly, which is probably one of his most famous song, you know, the theme song?
Yeah, well, I love that. I absolutely love that song.
Right, and did you know that that part
yeah.
at the beginning? You know that he was trying to emulate, like, a coyote sound?
Yeah.
I mean, it's that kind of, like... idea that I think I really enjoy about his music, because he just doesn't just compose it. He, you know, takes stuff that's working in real life and kind of brings it in as part of his song.
Well, see, that's the thing that I really liked about Ennio Morricone in general, is that he's open to influences from quite literally anything that makes sound. And a lot of his soundtracks have this wonderful ability to capture the sort of tone of the scenes that he's scoring so beautifully. Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is a perfect place to start because, you know, you're dealing with... A perfect example is the final shootout in the big graveyard. When Tuco and Blondie and Lee Van Cleef are just sort of running around through the graves there looking for this one specific grave, the music is very, very... It starts off very kind of gentle, you know, as everyone's just sort of looking around. And then, as everyone becomes more and more desperate to find this specific grave, to beat everyone else to it, it becomes this very, very kind of frenetic music. And it's driven by this absolutely amazing guitar line that, you know, has a sort of Spanish flamenco feel to it, which, you know, obviously gives it a sort of speed, kind of hyperness to begin with. But what's really so awesome about it is that the guitar is so heavily reverbed in there that it creates this sort of feeling of almost being lost in the immensity of the desert. You can practically hear the music, just like the you know, the actors shout and stuff like that. You can honestly hear it echoing off the mesas in the distance. And it creates this... The scene itself is this wonderfully wide open, huge kind of desolate region, and where, you know, any sound is going to just echo and disappear into the desert, and the music reflects that perfectly.
Right. It really paints a really great portrait of you know, your setting too, you know. And you know, they say like film, 90% of that is all music. It's all soundtrack that gives it a sense of realism. I mean, otherwise, if you're just watching that with an alternate soundtrack, it's not going to feel like you're in the desert. You're not going to feel like a thirst for water or anything like that. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it also helps that he works very closely with the director to get that kind of input on
exactly
what kind of sound to produce.
But, well, that's the thing that Morricone did so well with. The thing is, John Carpenter had invented that basic theme, because John Carpenter actually is a very,
he's
very
a good
composer.
Yeah, you know, he did the Halloween. It's Halloween. He wrote that. You know that.
Yeah,
and it's a very simple, you know, keys, but it's very frightening as well.
And that's what Carpenter does so well, is that most of the themes to his films are actually pretty basic. They're real simple, really minimalist types of music. But most of his films, though, are minimalist types of films. I mean, if you look at Halloween or The Thing, you've got a very limited cast. Halloween takes place basically on a single block, two people's houses. And The Thing takes place entirely in a very, very confined location, you know, a very claustrophobic research station. It may be lost in this huge immensity of Antarctica, although it was filmed in Alaska. But all the action of the film really takes place within that very, very confined research station. And that sort of very minimalistic, almost claustrophobic-sounding music really contributes to that beautifully. Huh. And that's what makes Morricone so impressive, too, is that he took that basic idea of Carpenter and fit it perfectly to the environment in which the film has taken place.
Do you keep up with Carpenter's recent films and whereabouts?
Yeah, I have pretty much everything he's done for the last... Well, honestly, I think I have everything that Carpenter has ever done, period. I wasn't too thrilled with the one Masters of Horror episode that he did, Pro-Life. I thought that one was just completely stupid.
I actually haven't seen that, but I've seen his other Masters of Horror episode, which was...
Cigarette Burns?
Right. That's actually a pretty decent one, but the angels and the film... Once you see it, you have to claw out your eyes. Like, I don't...
Yeah.
Then why do you want to see this film? But it seems like everybody's obsessed with it.
Well, it kind of goes back to that whole you know, the list over in Britain. As soon as something becomes forbidden, everyone wants to see
it. Right.
You want to know, what is so forbidden about this?
You know what? I wasn't too crazy about his Mars movie, The Vampires of Mars.
Yeah, Ghosts of Mars.
Oh, God. That was bad. And I think maybe Ice Cube also helped kill the movie for me, because I hope it comes back and do decent films, because I think lately anything that I've seen from him recently, I have not been too impressed with it. And I don't really count The Master of Horror as part of his filmography, because that, to me, that's more like an episodic, like a television
exactly.
show, not a feature film. And I hope he comes back and do a really good, like, you know, like when they're talking about doing a remake of Halloween, I want to see him do that. But I know from hearing interviews that he refused to revisit his old films. But I hope he at least help out, because I want to see him back in the you know, director's seat. Because
I
enjoy
him,
his work.
I'd like to see him exploring more the same type of surrealist horror that he did. His last great film that as far as I'm concerned, is In the Mouth of Madness, which was just this
wonderful...
Oh, yeah,
wonderful, that's a great one. What's his name? He starred in The Omen 3 or Omen 4, that British actor. You don't see
Jürgen Prochnow.
Right. You don't see him around anymore, but for a while, I loved his work. He just has a sense of... kind of like an everyman to him that I really enjoy watching him.
And the way that he played Sutter Kane in that film was, it was very, very like, he played the character almost deadpan.
Right, he's very dry.
He had this sort of very subtle sense of menace to him, which, considering that this was, he was playing a character as a horror writer literally created it. Turns out that everything he was writing about is true, and that he literally has the power. The best line in the entire film was, "God is not supposed to be a hack horror writer." But what if he were? I mean, that's what the film is about, and it just it has this wonderfully like pulp kind of elements to it. But just like the works of H.P. Lovecraft, who, you know, that was the guy I specialized in. I absolutely love his material. Much like H.P. Lovecraft, you've got these really pulpy horror kind of elements, but they're being used to deal with these really deep subjects. And that makes the film, you know, it's got a little bit of everything in it. It makes you think, but it also has cool monsters and... just wonderful settings.
You know, the thing about H.P. Lovecraft is, because I've read a few of his collections, that because he used to write for all these like pulp magazines,
Weird Tales,
and the reason, see, I've always get lost in some of his words, because he would overly exaggeratively describe things that, like, you know, let's say if he's talking about Cthulhu or something like that, right? He would go on and on about, you know, all this details, basically, about it. And I found out that the reason why is because the magazine pays per word. And so it was his best interest to squeeze in as much description. And I mean, his storyline is maybe, like, at best, like, you know, four lines. You know what I mean? But he has the ability to...
What's interesting... Yeah. I'm sorry. What's interesting about his stuffs is that he's kind of... He was always interested in creating atmosphere, because, as Lovecraft put it, really, a storyline is only frightening if there's some kind of atmosphere to surround it. And he was doing basically what Sergio Leone was doing in film, only in print. He was spending time on these lush descriptions of... horrific characters or locations, because really what makes a story frightening in print is that atmosphere that
right,
you
that
get.
Imagination,
I mean,
that you get from reading all the descriptions. Yeah, I totally understand that. But I think I just found it really funny. It's the, I think part of the origin was that because they pay per word that he would, you know, go over the top and just go all out, and you know what I mean?
Which makes perfect sense. I mean, if you're getting paid for the word, you might as well, the more words you have, the better you're going to do.
But, and I think that it's actually the case with a lot of Pope writers of that era. So if you go back and read any of The Shadow or any of those Pope, you know, Lone Rangers, this is very descriptive. And you know, I think it works well with radio, too, where they translate that on the radio, you know.
Very much so. As a matter of fact, that's one of the things that I've always found most impressive about that era of writing is that it lends itself to audio and musical exploration very, very, very well. And when I started writing music of my own, as a matter of fact, which was about 1992, when I discovered that learning a new instrument, I really couldn't afford to buy synthesizers. They were each like $2,500 and up. But I did have a computer, and I had just gotten a sound card for it, and I discovered that, oh, hey, you can make music with your computer. When I started doing that kind of stuff, right from the very beginning, I had in my mind, especially since I'm so obsessed with H.P. Lovecraft and John Carpenter, I had in mind that I was going to start writing stuff that was very, very similar to that, that was going to take these kinds of stories and implement them in a sort of audio format, to take the atmospheric elements that were described in print and then to create those atmospheric details in sound. And that's one of the reasons why Morricone was such a huge influence on the work that I do, but also just led to a much, much greater appreciation of the types of fiction, because I was reading this stuff and I started hearing in my head what I would think the music or what I would think a radio play of this would sound like. And that type of material, H.P. Lovecraft's type of stuff, lends itself so brilliantly to that, because there's so much detail in the story itself that you can, as a composer, a person can take and use that as a basis for creating either piece of incidental music or a kind of audio sculpture soundtrack piece. It's just fascinating. It's amazing how well that type of writing lends itself to musical adaptation.
Can I ask you what kind of software you were using at the time in the 90s? What kind of audio software were you using?
I started off with a program called Mod Edit, because a lot of my friends, see, I was, oddly enough, I didn't have very many musician friends when I had graduated from high school, mainly because I didn't play anything. But I had these ideas about composition and whatnot, and I really couldn't get anyone to help out or take part in that. I had some friends who were guitarists, for instance, but they were only interested in being the next Nirvana. They had absolutely no interest in doing anything other than producing your very, very standard loud, soft, grunge metal anthems, I guess you could say.
And yeah, for a time, I think all bands really wanted that kind of grungy sound. Understandable, because it was such an influence on popular culture at the time. And it's actually kind of depressing that Kurt Cobain, really such an idol, that would basically commit suicide. And although some people would argue Courtney Love killed him. But,
yeah, exactly. God knows, if I was married to her, I'd probably want to kill myself too, but that's beside the point. What's interesting, though, is that, I was really into computers and stuff in the early 90s. I've always been a big computer nerd. I mean, I was programming stuff in BASIC in third grade on a TRS-80 from Radio Shack.
Did you ever do Pascal or any of those early?
Oh yeah, Pascal, BASIC, C, C++, J++. I fiddled around with every one of those programming languages.
I used to really love BASIC, and I love the command line go to.
Like, yeah,
I would have that in subcategories of everything. So I'll have like if thens and a lot of. And some of them can get really complicated as far as, but it was kind of restrictive because everything had numbers, and if you had like a 140 and then 141, you're screwed because you can't put a different line between that.
Exactly, that you had to renumber everything.
Right, right, and so yeah, and you know, I mean, from a very basic, program, and everybody was told, you know, 10, 20, 30, and then like,
yep.
But I mean, it was very basic. Once you get to a certain point, that kind of language kind of died, in my opinion, because of the limitation that it had.
Yeah, I mean, if you're limiting yourself to specific line numbers like that, and you can only use whole numbers, it, you know, naturally between 1 and 10, you're only going to have 10 lines of code, and that's all you can have in there. So if you want to go back and edit that, you've got to edit the entire numerical structure, the entire thing. And, you know, it's interesting that you actually bring that up, because ModEdit, the program that I first started writing music on, was set up almost exactly like that. It was almost like an implementation of BASIC code to arranging sounds. Now,
so was it like just what? Sections of music in certain order?
How pretty much, yeah. It was one of the very first trackers ever created. And, you know, to this day, I still use trackers as my primary composing my primary composing device, because they're very, very intuitive, and they let you can literally just plop notes and stuff out on a screen in a very, very linear kind of fashion. You can see where everything is kind of lining up, so that, you know, you can line up sounds with certain beats, things like that. The trackers make it very, very easy in that regard. And ModEdit was incredibly primitive. You could only have four tracks on screen to work with, so that, you know, you could put your percussion in one track. That would be your drum files. Next thing would be a bass line in another one. And all this stuff was developed primarily for what was called the mod scene back in the the demo scene back in the early 90s. Trackers were developed to create soundtracks to little films of computer animation. And the demo scene was huge. I mean, it really was. And these trackers were pretty much developed specifically so that people could write pieces of music that would then have a certain structure that the coders could use to sync the different computer graphics to the actual, you know, elements of the music itself. Now, I never got into the whole demo thing myself because I always thought of myself more as a musical arranger than, you know, like a programmer or anything like that. And I just got into it because, hell, I'm not going to have to worry about getting all my friends together to make some kind of music. I can do it all myself. So, as long as I have the right sampled sounds, I can make anything.
All right. Let's skip to 2008. What kind of program are you using right now, and that you recommend, actually?
There's a program called Renoise that is the greatest tracker ever created by anybody. I mean, it's just absolutely amazing.
Or is it based out of U.S.? Because some of these software that I know are like from other countries that are really good. I mean, especially with techno.
Oh, absolutely.
So is
Europe is huge for that kind of stuff.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, Renoise is centered in the UK. And
yeah, that's why I figured, because I don't think the U.S. has that kind of audience to really produce a software as you know, as hefty as what you want.
Exactly. Matter of fact, all the development on Renoise, for instance, is primarily, it only makes sense that it's done in Europe, where, one, that style of music is very, very popular, and two, that's where the demo scene back in the early 90s really got started anyway, was in Europe. So a lot of the electronic music software that's being produced these days is still coming out of that area, because it's still driven by people who were inspired by the demo scene, for instance, who were inspired by making mods and things like that, using Mod Edit back in the early 90s. And what you see today is that basic scene having evolved into a full-fledged musical production environment. You can pretty much do anything with Renoise, for instance. You can record guitar parts into it. So in that regard, it's kind of like a cross between your old school tracker and
kinda
a
like
contemporary.
A
pardon
it sounds
me?
Like it sounds like it could be a replacement for a studio or something where it's all
exactly
happening right on your computer instead of.
As a matter of fact, right. You can use. Myself, I use Renoise, and sometimes I also use Sonar, Cakewalk Sonar 7, to do some extra MIDI stuff. You know, they're trackers are very, very powerful, but there are certain things that you can't do in a tracker that you can do in a program like Sonar. But between the two of those, I've got a complete music production environment on my computer, and a lot of the actually my primary group that I work with these days is Nyarlathotep, Lathotep, the Crawling Chaos, you know, an obvious Lovecraft reference there, and we have we're even though we're primarily electronic, we have a violinist, Megan Irving from Pittsburgh. She's just absolutely amazing, and what I usually do is we'll produce most of the song structure in Renoise and then export the individual tracks, put them back together in Sonar, and then record Megan's violin parts in there as well. We've also had guitar parts done for certain songs, stuff like that. And with Sonar, you can kind of bring it all together. And the best part about it is, my studio is quite literally, it costs, I think, less than $1,000 to put the whole thing together.
Right.
Renoise itself is only $40.